Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Knowing Me, Knowing You. Knowing me, Alan Partridge. Knowing you, the audience. I've got a hit on my hands.
Monkey tennis?
Is that good therapy or balmy old cack?
Conrad Knightson.
Monkey tennis?
I'm Alan Partridge.
Why are you such a dick?
Lots of meaty chat.
Monkey tennis?
I just want you to admit that you hate Les Dennis.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
Monkey tennis?
Okay, I'm in Manhattan. What do I do now?
You are a little shit.
Monkey tennis?
That in England is a whore.
I've taken drugs!
Lord Morgan.
If you speak again, I will physically hit you.
And on that bombshell,
Monkey tennis?
Thank goodness it's radio. I never thought I'd say that.
Hello and welcome for the final time this series to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. We've been weaving our way through Knowing Me, Knowing You, the radio series, and now we've come to the end with a final episode about knowing me, knowing you, and also our thoughts and your thoughts about the series as a whole. I'm Adam Brooks and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
Lisa, get me a black coffee and a slim panatella.
Nick Older.
Quite frankly, I'd be happy with a picture of the family there.
And Tom Stab.
Let's lick this bitch.
So, yes, Knowing Me, Knowing You was a sort of a spoof documentary about the spoof chat show, effectively, wasn't it? Tom Dark, you've got a bit of insight about when this went out and how it all worked.
Yeah, this broadcast on the 3rd of July, 1993. So this was basically added on to the first repeats of Knowing Me, Knowing You in June, 93. So they aired the six episodes again with this on the end of that run. I think the way they intro the show is Knowing Me, Knowing You, 1 week in the life of Pear Tree Productions.
Which really opens the door. I mean, I've mentioned this before, really opens the door to the possibility of a sort of a Pear Tree series, which I still think would be fascinating and brilliant and a great addition to Alan. I can't believe they've never thought to do something like that before.
I didn't know this existed.
Well, I mean, until they did do this.
Well, sure, yes, that's true, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know this existed before coming to do the research for this series. Did anyone else know that this was a thing?
Hang on, loads of people have been in touch saying, have you guys seen this on the socials like the last 4 years?
Yeah, come on, Tom. Everyone's been
in touch. Yeah, and I hadn't seen it. I didn't know it existed.
I hadn't seen it either.
They told us about it, but I didn't know it existed.
But do you mean before doing the podcast overall or before doing the research for this?
Well, doing the podcast overall, I guess, because I'd also never listened to it in the meantime when we were told about it.
I was so out the loop. I genuinely thought it was a real documentary. So when I started listening to it, I was like, oh, this is brilliant.
Yeah.
So I thought I was going to have to listen to a documentary of Steve going, oh, and then we'll do this. And then Patrick go,
it's very good.
Maybe you should be an impressionist.
You want spitting image, Nick?
When I actually heard what it was, I thought, this, guys, is going to be a lot of fun to talk about.
So can I just shock you? It's actually good.
Yeah. Yep.
So this is a fictitious documentary, and it's pitched to have taken place between episodes 5 and 6 of Knowing Me, Knowing You. So they've done the episode in Vegas, but they're yet to have your man from Glossop die on the show.
Yeah, so it's all around the episode 4, as it broadcast on Radio 4, isn't it? So it's the Duchess of Stranraer, Sandra Peaks episode, isn't it?
Yeah.
It opens with producer Mario Santini, who is Armando Iannucci, which is nice because you haven't seen him play anyone.
Well, I also thought, even before you get to that, there's a line admitting that the show isn't great and effectively comparing it to a polytechnic, which, if we're being honest, is probably a pejorative in its own right. Yeah. So already the standard is being set that it's at best fine.
But there's a line that says it's an award-winning chat show.
Well, this is what I was going to say. What is the award that it's won?
Like, well, in real life, it did win an award, but I don't actually know what that award was.
But yeah, yeah,
in the APU.
Not in the APU, though.
No, yeah. I mean, no. he only gets up to being TV Quick's man at the moment, and that still is yet to happen in the future.
Yeah, well, yeah. On TV, yeah. So they say we're still suffering from the Vegas trip, which is obviously our first clue it's happened.
A bit of a budget problem.
Yeah. So need to budget a bit more carefully for the rest of the series. That confused me a bit because I thought this was between episodes 5 and 6, meaning there's only one episode of the series left.
Well, I mean, I can get into this now if you like. I've kind of looking at this, I think I've kind of figured out where this should actually fall. And essentially, for whatever reason, I don't think the Radio 4 broadcast in the original order they were planned to. So we talked about kind of at the beginning of this run that the episode order in the Every Ruddy Word script books seems to be wrong. But it actually makes a bit more sense when you look at this now. So in the book, the episode order is... And going with the episode numbers as per the Radio 4 broadcast is getting confusing. In the book, it's episode 1, 3, 5, 2, 4, and 6. So episode 1 and episode 6 are consistently the first and the last, which makes a lot of sense because you have Alan introducing himself to the audience and you have, obviously, the wrap-up with Tony Hayes at the end in episode 6. But yeah, this documentary... he's been to Vegas, but it's before Sandra Peaks, so it has to be between, which means at the very least...
Doesn't that mean at the very least that there's 2 episodes left? So when they say we've got to budget more carefully for the rest of the series, that makes sense because there is more than one episode left in the series.
So at the very least, it could all be in order apart from the last 3, which would have to be 5, 4, 6. So basically, I think the book order is correct. That in essence, it gets very confusing comparing all the different episode numbers, and it makes more sense if you see it written down. But I think Every Ruddy Word has the original running order, so I'd no idea why it didn't air in that order.
We've got a bit, just to peek behind the curtain, we've got like a massive like wall chart where we've got arrows like drawn to each other, like how this all worked, conspiracy theories, like we've broken this down. We really have.
Even more interesting that Every Ruddy Word's actually got something right, because we've learned throughout this series that it is littered with errors. So there's a bit of chat about Alan's car that he's gambled away in Vegas, and an implication that Pear Tree has had to cover the cost of that. They also claim that they had John Goodman as a guest, but of course he never appeared. And you also find out that one of the producers is called Rosie. I wondered if there might have been a Rosie May crossover, but possibly not. Maybe I'm stretching.
So of course this is the obviously this follows the arc of a week. So this is the Monday 8:30 a.m. production meeting that we're listening in on first of all. So obviously what they're talking about here is the guests that they think they have in the frame for the show as it is Monday, but things will change as this progresses. So yeah, at the moment, the lineup is looking like the Duchess of Stranraer, John Goodman, and Bill Pickley. Up, 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 down, 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 jiggy, 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 round, round, round. Now, I'm pretty sure Bill Pickley is a fictional creation for the purposes of this documentary. So in the APU, he was the star of a comedy series from the 70s called Mad Boys. I think I've got that. Does that cover the main detail? Yeah.
I like the fact that this production meeting, they are complaining, I think, that Alan's late. He arrives, and then 2 minutes later, he leaves to buy a penguin.
Oh, and also, he just pops in to basically say he's taken the liberty of hiring a car.
Yep.
So when they're concerned about overspending, he's just taking all the money.
He's hired a Montego, and he wants it on expenses. Yeah,
he's slapped it on expenses are the words he chooses to use.
We also learn quite quickly that Alan tends to change the introduction monologues on the day, ignoring all the scriptwriter's hard work, and we'll see that develop throughout the episode as well.
Tom, as someone who has had a bit of involvement in a chat show or being involved in chat shows, have you ever been in a chat show production meeting?
Oh no, that's very much the other side of what I
understand that, but like, I just wondered if maybe you at some point in your career, you might have been in one. If this is fairly accurate, you imagine that this is pretty accurate? Going through budgets, going through the guests that week, or would this have been booked like way, way, way in advance? And this is a bit of a liberties that they're taking.
No, I think it's kind of possible that they're coming to this saying, here's who we think we have confirmed for the show. But obviously, things can change at the last minute. So, yeah, I think as this develops, there are a few things later on that definitely chime with reality, I think, as to how this would all play out.
They've also had problems with Alan changing the scripts. He doesn't quite understand the way that things are supposed to go, and so he's been changing a lot of things himself.
On the day as well, that's crucial.
On the day, like, yeah.
It's all last minute.
Oh yeah, which kind of comes back later when he's been working through the night. Well, he's been getting someone to work through the night to write his monologues. A little bit of information about Alan's pub order here. He always orders a jumbo sausage and mash because he claims that it takes the edge off any issue, takes the seriousness out of it. Just the presence of a large sausage on the table just makes everyone a bit more at ease.
So at that point, this is now 1:30 PM on Monday. So this is Alan and Pat are in the pub having lunch. So Pat is basically Alan's scriptwriter. So just before they're in the pub, there's a little interview with Pat, and he reveals he used to write for Brian Connolly, Richard Digents, Shane Ritchie, as he describes, the new cutting edge people in comedy. And I also enjoyed that he says working on scripts of Alan is like wading through sludge.
I've got that. Do you think that this is again the writers having a bit of a dig maybe at the bigger writers of the day, that they didn't see themselves in that kind of category, but these are the kind of the mainstream of that year?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I think we can all agree that Brian Connolly and Shane Ritchie were probably never considered to be cutting edge people in comedy, were they?
I used to love Brian Connolly.
Same. It's a puppet.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, really, yeah, good. And that still makes sense, Nick, because it's definitely not cutting edge, so it very much works for you.
I thought it was quite pioneering for its day, to be honest.
I did also like the description of what working with Alan is like as a friendly war, like when they played football in World War One.
Yeah.
Did anyone else have to look up Richard Digents? I'd never heard of him. But again, maybe that's an age thing.
I've heard the name and I didn't bother looking it up.
Yeah, he's just a presenter.
Great.
I've got to say, I didn't love this documentary. I think it's on the edge of not being funny. And I think it perhaps made more sense when it first went out because Alan was being fleshed out as a person behind the scenes for the first time. But given that we've seen so much of Alan over the years, I'm not totally sure what it adds. And I mean, it probably took more editing and more voices and more planning than an episode of the radio series, but I'm just not convinced it delivers. I wonder if I'm the only one that feels that way.
I thought it was better than all of the radio shows, personally.
Really?
Staggering.
I thought it was brilliant.
I think it presents Alan as being sort of, in some ways, not in every way, but in some ways, a bit more sensible, a bit more reasonable. It's almost better to see the radio episodes without knowing his
I'm not sure
process.
I agree with that. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if we're jumping ahead a little bit to kind of.
I'm not saying it makes him look reasonable. I'm saying it makes him look more reasonable than if you just saw the show.
I get that.
I think that, again, not to jump too far ahead in terms of what the review is, but might as well just jump to it. The radio series, I felt, was, again, things that I had essentially seen before. That's not to say it isn't funny, but I felt that this was new in terms of a format, even though it follows more in the kind of footsteps of a I'm Alan Partridge or, maybe even a Mid-Morning Matters. Maybe less of Mid-Morning Matters. It felt like a new format that we hadn't seen before, so it kind of felt like new Alan, and therefore I enjoyed it more.
I think at this point, they're also kind of discovering the character themselves and experimenting themselves. They're trying things out. I don't know, obviously, we don't really have any intel of what the writers or Steve, like how they hold this, like, do they think that this is good, basically?
I doubt it crosses their mind, to be honest.
I think it's...
No, but I mean, if you asked them, do you think it was good? I don't know. We have no intel on what they think about this.
But I think it speaks volumes that in terms of there's only one way that this was ever commercially available, which was that
Director's
book set. You know, it's not kind of seen as canon, as it were. It's like whenever people have got in touch with us over the years saying, if you cover KMKY radio, make sure you include this, and it's only because it exists on YouTube as a few things, it's like it's very hard to actually get hold of it in a legitimate fashion.
I would buy this if it was on Audible as part of that series. I would buy it.
I'll just send you the MP3, mate.
But again, I think this, like, to the point we made about how there's a little bit of crossover with this and I'm Alan Partridge, there are elements. It is documentary, but there's also stuff that is kind of sketchy a little bit. There's little scenes and whatever. I think this would work better as visual rather than audio. I think it would be better in that format.
Should we rejoin the script at the Tuesday 10 AM production meeting now? So at this point, the Pear Tree production staff are discussing whether they should cover the Sandra Peake story. You've got Mario is asking Pat to include it in the opening monologue. suggesting that they should get her on the show instead of some of the guests that they're already looking at. One of the characters says, "You've got to be careful, she's very litigious," which it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. And there was a line that really, really tickled me here. And it's when you hear, I think it's David Schneider's character just going, "It's down, down, down for Bill Pickley." That just really, really makes me laugh, because he's almost like doing a chart show rundown and using that kind of pre-inbuilt gag about up, 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 down, down, down.
And it transpires that Bill has been dropped at the last minute before.
Yes, so that's then Jason, so one of the researchers slash bookers who obviously becomes referenced quite a lot in the APU along with Lisa, the booking team. He phones Bill Pickley's agent saying, "I'm afraid we've had to move in a different direction." Now, that is one of the things that feels very realistic. It's that classic kind of vague reasoning with a show getting in touch why they don't want to commit to a booking. So, Tom, when you were asking about does this kind of feel quite realistic, that's exactly the sort of excuse you'd give, like, "We're moving in a different direction." It doesn't actually mean anything. It's basically saying, "We've decided to go with something we think is better."
Have you ever had to make that call?
No, that'd be somebody calling me.
Right.
And I did pull out a line from iPartridge talking about Jason and Lisa. Alan writes, "Unable to afford celebrity bookers, we relied on two researchers, Lisa and Jason, to approach agents. And on the whole, they did a good job." So it's always that thing, like, he's laying it out that a lot of the blame with what happens on the show can be laid at Lisa and Jason, because they're not actually proper bookers. They're just researchers. And they've gone, "Well, we're not going to bother paying somebody to do this job properly, just you can do it as well."
He's also said, on the whole, they do a good job, but he did sack Lisa immediately after doubling everyone else's salary at Peartree.
Next up, it's the production meeting. It's 10 a.m. on Wednesday, and I actually say, I wonder, they're pretty much having daily production meetings. I don't know how many meetings they'd have to keep discussing who's going to be on the show.
It's moving fast. It's moving in a different direction. They need to keep on top of it. So Jason has gone to the comedy shop in town, and he's seen...
I'm assuming that's supposed to be the comedy store, but they just couldn't or wouldn't use the real name yet.
Yeah. Just the comedy shop. Yep. This is in Naughty Norwich as well, remember? Was it an attitude? It's more than...
Norwich is an attitude.
It's the comedy shop is in London. They say it's near Leicester Square. So even more like the real comedy store.
Well, Steve Thompson has been spotted by Jason, and Alan is flattered because obviously he's done an impression of him. So Alan is kind of keen to get him on the show because obviously it helps kind of bolster his ego as someone of such a stature that people would want to impersonate him. Although it does get to such a point where it's discussed that Steve could potentially dress up as Alan and then host the show. To which Alan goes, no, that's not going to happen.
He's gone too far.
You've gone too far.
And I think following this, we have a little segment with Alan and Pat are starting to write down some links, aren't they? I think Alan is asking Pat to take some gags out. And he's also, and then you have this quite weird kind of monologue where Alan talks about feeling like he wants to hit people.
Again, this is the violent thread kind of that we see sort of running through this series, where Alan says that, you know, that he does have a system to control when he wants to hit someone. So he might imagine that they're a saint or a holy figure, or someone who has given their life for someone who doesn't deserve to be hit. So it could be a victim, a pauper, or someone in a workhouse in the 18th century. It sounds odd, but that is how he controls his desire to stop hitting people.
It really is quite odd, because it's quite divergent from what's going on in the script, but it is also quite nice because it's just giving a bit more depth to the character. Like, you talk about this violent streak, this having a bad temper, and kind of he has these kind of weird things he goes through in his imagination to justify what he's thinking. It's all very strange, but it also works quite nice as a proper insight into this kind of insane character.
Very complicated mind.
Complicated man.
Yep. Next up, it's John Goodman, and it's not good news.
it's the Friday morning production meeting, another one. We don't know if they had a Thursday morning production meeting, actually. That doesn't seem to come up in this. We find out here that John Goodman's pulled out.
John Goodman's done a Sue Cook.
Very good.
Yeah, and the reason is that Alan has insisted that John Goodman stay in a Holiday Inn, and John Goodman's agent has insisted on Claridge's. I did have a little look on Claridge's website. The cheapest room that you can get on Claridge's currently for this weekend is £1,110
per night.
And also, you don't actually, I haven't got the details here, but I remember looking at it, you don't actually get that much. It's like free Wi-Fi and coffee and stuff like that. You don't really get anything
extra.
Hold on,
free Wi-Fi? Yes, please.
For £1,110 a night, please.
I love the way way this scene transpires, because you have Armando Iannucci's character absolutely loses. He's like, yeah. Alan spoke to her. Alan never, ever speaks to anyone's agent. That is so good. So Mario and Alan have a bit of a face-off here. We have Armando Iannucci's character, Mario, saying, I thought we expressly agreed before this series started you would not speak to anyone's agent. So I think they know that Alan's a liability. And I think Alan, the back and forth, you have Alan saying to, who are you? Obviously, Mario says, I'm the producer. And Alan's saying, and I am Alan Partridge. So we know he's an absolute narcissistic shit back in the early incarnation, obviously. Although it does gradually back down and end with, this segment ends with, I'm very sorry I made a mistake. I'm only human. Again, a rare instance of humility with Alan there.
Yeah, that's not going to be making much more of an appearance.
I'm definitely not following the subsequent phone call, which is Alan calling Bill Pickley.
Oh, yeah, which escalates into such a fervour that there's an admission in there that Alan wears a weave, which I thought was interesting.
I think we know immediately as soon as he phones Bill that this is going to go badly. It's going to end in him hanging up or Bill hanging up.
So I assume it's kind of a double-edged thing. He's making a call to try and apologise and also presumably rebook him because they now have a John Goodman-shaped hole in the show. And obviously, yeah, it descends into a shouting match and Alan hanging up. It's a weave. I don't have to take this. And then to alleviate his stress, he asked Lisa to get him a black coffee and a slim panatella.
I had to Google panatella.
Same.
Why didn't he just say cigar? Anyway,
it's a brand.
Is it a brand or is it just a type?
Yeah, it's not a brand.
Is it not?
No.
Is it just,
I think it's just a type. It's
a type, like a cigar. Like a cigarillo, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm. Okay.
I just don't know why they didn't say cigar. Anyway, doesn't really matter.
Maybe everyone was walking around talking about panatellas back in the early 90s.
Mm. Anyone else here smoked a cigar?
We've all done it, mate.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I wasn't expecting that.
No, there we go. Very proud.
Nick's got his own walk-in humidor.
I was shocked by what happens shortly after this, in that we hear Carol.
Yeah.
Can't believe it. I mean, I guess this is before the days when they felt they could get more mileage out of being quite cagey about having her appear or be heard.
So. Well, I think this is the only time that Carol is heard in the APU.
And to be fair, it is mainly just the sound of her falling over
and crying.
Yeah. So for the context, it's now midnight and they're writing at Alan's home. So I think this must be midnight Friday going into Saturday, perhaps.
Yeah.
So Alan's got a glass of port on the go. Pat has a brandy. And I quite like, there are quite a few instances. Alan and Pat definitely like a drink, because even on the Monday lunchtime, they're like cheersing a couple of pints and stuff.
You also get the first reference to his fan of samurai swords, which cost him $5,000. Although he says, quite frankly, I'd be happy with the picture of the family there, which I think is quite a poignant message and a theme of Alan's, that basically he buys things for himself to try and cover for the paper, the cracks in his family life.
Yeah, but it's also the thing, I think he's only saying he'd be happy with the picture of the family there because Pat has branded them vulgar trappings. So suddenly he's trying to like backpedal from the vulgarity that he's got surrounding him in his home.
He lists off some of the vulgarities, unnecessarily so, but he does list off some of the vulgarities. So such as the rockery around the fireplace. But the one I did enjoy the most was the grotto for the video. The idea that a video lives in a grotto.
I thought the noises we get from Carol, you could almost extrapolate that she's still a zombie as well at this point.
Pat goes, is she all right? And Alan just goes, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm guessing the implication is supposed to be that she's hammered, right?
I don't think so.
Not sure.
No,
is it just supposed to be like really muffled, disgruntled noises?
Alan's hammered.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, God. Do you want another drink?
Oh, I love the line, give yourself a break. Do you want a panatella? I'm having one, mate. Basically, he's constantly drinking and chain-smoking cigars at this point.
I've got the mental image of basically Alan, just drinking and smoking and just leaning over Pat's shoulder, who is doing all of the work. Alan gets to 2 a.m. and then effectively just leaves Pat to continue writing the script.
He's off to bed.
Yeah, he says to Pat, you just write whatever you want.
I'm going to hit the sack, mate.
Then you hear lots of banging around and I think Alan and Carol are having some kind of argument. But all you can really make out is Alan going, why? Carol's crying and Alan going, I love you.
Yeah. Carol very much in tears at this point.
It's a bit sad though, didn't you think? Because definitely, you know, they're marriage relationship problems.
There wasn't a huge amount of humour in the moments where you can actually hear them arguing either.
No, exactly.
A bit distressing.
Yeah.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC.
Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Voluma XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So we're now up to show day, Pat having written a script through the night. Alan bumps into the security man at Paris Studios, George, who I thought was clearly an early Simon prototype.
Yeah, good point.
Not least because we know from our special live episode with Simon Greenall that there were original ideas of Simon being a Cockney rather than a Geordie. Mm. And that's very much the George role here.
Mm, yeah, Geordie, Cockney, and also the discussed him being from Yorkshire as well.
Yeah, yeah. So so Alan says to George, not let any Nazis past, have you?
Yeah, because he does say, I could tell you a story about that, which kind of plays into the idea of a Michael who has kind of, you know, stories.
Oh, yeah.
He's seen some shit.
Hadn't really clocked that could be a prototype. Yeah.
But Alan does say, another time.
So yeah, I mean, he's excited about John Goodman and Bill Pickley being on the show, so he's going to be disappointed.
Yeah. George hasn't heard of Sandra Peaks, to which point Alan says, you really should read the papers, George. Do try and keep up.
And actually, that would almost work as the Michael prototype as well.
Yeah,
I
exactly.
mean, you know, I still love the thing Simon Greenwood told us about that scene that never made it to air about him never having watched the news at 10.
I've near seen it.
Michael, you haven't seen 10.
There's a nice tidbit here as well that Alan's encouraged to use the phrase "and on that bombshell" by staff behind the scenes. I would have thought that would be entirely his own invention, but
no,
he's egged on.
And we learn that Alan's dropped Pat's entire monologue from the show, even though Pat was up till 6 a.m. writing it.
Also, is it 2 a.m. when Alan goes to bed?
4 hours.
Four more hours to write the monologue.
To write a bit of script that would probably last a minute at most.
He was probably fired up by Alan's parting thing of saying, oh, you can write whatever you want. He's like, finally, I'm going to write my masterpiece and get it on telly.
And he's just chugging away on port and panatellas whilst he does it.
It also turns out the bad news is that the production will not cover Alan's 20 grand check to the Rent Boys. But they are paying for the cars he gambled away in Vegas. So
yeah,
a partial win.
So the point I made in the episode that covered this section is that in the documentary, they say your check. But as we know from the show itself, Alan's quote is, producers are telling me that you can have £16,000. So he's been told in his earpiece that he can have £16,000.
So that's the limit of like the show budget to basically get this scoop.
So all he needs to pay is £4,000 to top it up to 20. But now they're saying he has to pay the full £20,000. So I'm on Alan's side here that this is massively unfair because they've told him he can have 16.
But is it possible that they had that £16,000 earmarked, but they've actually ended up paying for the cars he gambled away in Vegas? So that's the Rent Boy money that has been spent on those cars.
Maybe. Before we kind of wrap up, like there's all that kind of good post-show discussion there. So there's a tiny segment where the Duchess arrives at the green room and she's just quite nervous. And I don't think that really adds anything, that whole section.
No.
It's like, again, it's a bit more behind the scenes, but there aren't really any like gags to find
there. The last few minutes are basically just a flat narration of the contents of episode 6, aren't they? It's almost like they kind of ran out of material.
I like the, when you can hear like the Mario character kind of in the control room during the show, and he's like saying, get her before she leaves the building. And then when when the rent boys come out, you can hear him going, good, well done. And suddenly he's really excited and engaged in kind of what's happening in the show. I thought that was quite fun.
Yeah, I really like that. That's kind of the Larry Sanders Show sort of thing, is where you see a bit in front and a bit behind as well.
Because it's almost like it flips from there, like going, oh, this is going terribly because like she's storming off, this is going to be a disaster. But because immediately the rent boys are out and they're happy to play ball with the expose. So then when they're having this kind of post-show analysis, you've got them going, great show. Alan Partridge brings down the government. Like, they're actually elated with how it's all played out.
Yeah, so within the conceit of the show and the documentary, they're all really happy with how it's gone. This show isn't a disaster.
Because you've got Alan, you know, on the script of the actual radio show, you've got Alan like saying, she's a broken woman. Yes, we have broken her. And they're also celebrating, like, Sandra Peaks isn't going to sue. So, yeah, it's kind of worked out really well for them. By that aspect.
I like, there's a little running joke about the producer always being away as well. He's like, I'm not in on Monday, I'm off Tuesday and Wednesday, we're all leaving for a drink now.
And he's away working on arguably better, more successful shows as
15
well.
15-1.
Yeah.
With William G. Stewart.
Yep.
I also like, there's a final quote that kind of sums Alan up quite nicely. Alan's a man of the people, but I suppose not everybody's people.
I really like the bit when Mario says to him, go and open a few more sports centres, you'll get the money.
Yeah.
And it kind of wraps up with another classic Alan line of self-affirmation. He says, I'm Alan Partridge, chatter man, of that there is no doubt. Kind of a precursor to Alan Carr, chatty man, weirdly.
Indeed, a fitting ending.
There's a through line from one to the other.
Yep. Yeah, so that kind of summarises this episode. And I think kind of like we've discussed as we've gone through, I think on my initial few listens, I wasn't that taken by it. I was kind of like thinking that the gags aren't that strong. I'm not really sure what it adds to it. But actually, the more I listen to it, it kind of like it reveals itself a bit and picking up on some quite subtle characterizations, which led me to a bit of a large thought that essentially, I think kind of like Tom was saying, this is kind of like the missing link between Know Me, Knowing You and I'm Alan Partridge, because it's the first time you get the character in a documentary or mockumentary setting. So yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all if when the making of this kind of inspired them to do the sitcom, which is that has that kind of documentary feel, kind of like laying that groundwork of going behind the scenes into Alan's daily life and the goldmine of comic opportunity that represents.
Yeah, it's the genesis, I suppose. I mean,
I think
I've got to say, I didn't love it, and I felt that it was a bit, it was very Radio 4. I thought the voice acting was quite showy, and I didn't think that kind of the behind the scenes nature of it was novelty enough to make up for it being some of it fairly weak material. But I think that's probably because I'm judging it quite harshly, because it was relatively pioneering in 1992, and there's been a lot of better mockumentary behind the scenes kind of funny, you know, looking at shows from an alternate angle.
That's a really good
point.
If you think about a first listen to this in 1993, it would have felt so different to a first listen to this in 2020, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, as you say, it's quite likely it was the genesis for things like I'm Alan Partridge, so I can hardly fault it if that's what it led to.
Yeah.
That's our thoughts on Knowing Me, Knowing You.
It's really annoying to say, isn't it?
Yeah. We will get on to our thoughts about Knowing Me, Knowing You, the radio series as a whole. But first, we wanted to hear from you, the humble listener, starting with a message that I believe my colleague Tom Stab has.
Hello. So we have had some tweets and emails from people, and we're just going to go through those, starting with Tom Burbage, who got in touch with us on Twitter, saying, guy at work, knowing we had similar taste, lent me the audio tapes of the series and I was hooked. My intro to the Partriverse. Haven't heard them in ages, but I have a recollection of a piece he does with a couple having therapy that had me in stitches every time because of the way he's so dismissive and self-centered with the guests.
Stuart Carter got in touch on email to say, my best memory of listening to the radio series was my dad driving me from Southeast England to Scotland for a scout camping trip that I almost missed because I had the day before badly broken my nose playing football and so missed the next morning train with the rest of the scout troop.
Sounds like something from I Partridge.
Yeah, a lot of detail. Yeah, a funny thing happened on the way to the scout camping trip by Stuart Carter with Stuart Carter. We bought the Kim Ki Wap radio series on cassette tape for our first stop at a motorway rest stop on the M1 and listened to it the whole car journey. My nose hurt from laughing, but I didn't care. Best line and interview from the show, Alan interviewing the child prodigy and using my favourite put down, I, Alan Partridge, would like to push you, Simon Fisher, into a very deep disused canal. I've also never forgotten the capital of Kenya, bloody Nairobi, and Frankenstein was the Genevan student and not the monster.
We had a couple of tweets through as well. Edward Emerson wrote to us, by far the best best Partridge ever. So many quotes get used so much in our house, they don't even register as Partridge quotes anymore. Hashtag wet boy. Hashtag are you winking at me? Hashtag it's a blouse. Hashtag I got bullets. Hashtag have you got any pubic hairs? Hashtag originality, quality and excellence. Tommy Taylor on Twitter said, back in day, I had the double cassette and I thought it was real until AP hit the TV screens. It holds a special place in my heart. I have it downloaded with the bonus episode, which is what we've just been talking about. And to this day, I love introducing new people to it and watching the reactions. We had another great tweet from Dave Datson, who wrote, best Partridge by far. From the very first interview of Lawrence Camley discussing their mutual admiration for Sherlock Holmes, you could see exactly who this character was. Ignorant, out of his depth, and completely lacking in self-awareness. And I think that beautifully sums it up.
Yeah, brilliant. We've also had another message in from Elliot Mayer, who wrote, I'd never listened to the radio show until I discovered your guys' podcasts. It made me hungry for Alan content I'd never seen before. So I listened to the radio shows and watched Mid-Morning Matters for the first time. Before the pod, I wasn't keen on them, but I've really come to love them. Cheers, guys.
Right, that's nice to know.
Yeah, that's really good.
And finally, in this section from listener feedback, we got an email from Matthew Fitzpatrick. Quite a long one, this one. As a young man, 15, I'd fallen in love with Kim Kiwap TV show and that had just been broadcast in the autumn of 1994. On Christmas Day of that year, to my absolute delight, my parents had got me the CD collection of the radio version, which I hadn't heard of. An inspired gift. Like the TV show, I became obsessed with the Radio 4 series, playing it over and over, learning the lines and basically becoming fully immersed in the six shows. It was absolute gold. As with the TV show, I found that I would quote it in real life incessantly throughout my teens, usually just for my own amusement, but also when the context demanded it. This came to a head at a family gathering where I found myself talking to two older relatives who were discussing some comedy show they'd recently watched. As the awkward teenager, I was very much on the periphery of this conversation, but felt I needed to contribute in some way. As the two relatives were struggling to precisely describe the facet of a key character's role in the show, I decided to roll out an Alan quote to smooth the cogs of the chat. You could say that he offers comic vignettes woven into the general fabric and architecture of the show, I said. This was, of course, a stolen quote I'd taken from Alan's erudite guest, Britain's greatest living novelist, Lawrence Camley, who had used the line to explain the comedic nature of his novels. Boom! Both relatives gave me a startled and quizzical look, but seemingly pretty impressed that I, a 16-year-old spotty teenager, had come out with such a well-articulated and pithy line to explain what they were talking about it. What a fraud I was. Fake it till you make it, eh? So I guess that's, you know, using Alan to... Alan quotes in real life, which I quite like, because I think that's something we can all probably relate to.
A rare occasion where using a quote from Alan can actually make you look smarter.
Yeah.
Thanks so much to everyone who's got in touch with their thoughts about Know Me, Know You, the radio series. It's probably time to chat a little bit about how we feel.
Ooh, it's the big one. Who wants to start?
I mean, I liked it.
Thanks, Nick.
I think from my perspective, the just as an overall, feedback, it was different. It was interesting for me coming to it kind of cold because I hadn't seen it before. And I think I hadn't heard
it before.
I've never seen it. But you do need to put yourself into the kind of, mindset or the context of this being so new and so original, because it's very easy to judge it with kind of 2020 perspective. And actually when you kind of go back and think that this is actually one of the first outings, I think that this is actually quite pioneering and groundbreaking, because a lot of what you see in terms of Alan's tropes, his kind of comedic style, his humor, they were doing this for the first time and finding their feet. And I think that that does deserve kind of a lot of credit and respect for essentially laying the foundations for what became one of, you know, my kind of favorite comedy characters of all time.
I like that this series felt much more about the guests. I like that they were quite well developed. I like that sometimes you're encouraged to side with them, but sometimes against them. It's not just all at Alan's expense. And because it came from a point where they'd been doing a lot more ensemble comedy, like The Day-to-Day and On the Hour, that kind of spirit of camaraderie is still there. And you can see the fun that they had in making this, even though, you know, a lot of it was repeated a lot and quite torturous in the improv stages when they were writing it. I feel like Know Me, Know You TV still featured the guests heavily, but the visual aspect made it much more about Alan, his name in lights, his interactions with the band, that sort of thing. So in this one, I think the guests were given a better backstory. And I also quite like that it quite rigidly follows a formula, three guests, about 7 minutes a guest. It makes it feel a bit more like almost like a sketch show in some ways, that you've got kind of self-contained little vignettes that don't often bleed into one another.
You could almost like make your own best of by just picking out your three favourite guests and putting them into one
and
show.
And it's punchy, isn't it? It moves at pace. It never feels slow or laboured or any of the guests. And, you know, some are better than others, but I think because of the format, because of the 7-minute rule, if you will, it doesn't really allow at any point for you to drag because it's moved on before you've even had kind of like any time for it to drag.
Mm. I mean, I really enjoy going back and doing this, and I think I might have been the only one that had heard it all before we actually came to do it.
You were definitely the advocate for Know Me, Know You radio, weren't you?
And I was actually surprised going back and covering this, the character consistency across the output and the writing teams of the APU. I wasn't expecting it to be so thorough. So it's kind of pulling the threads of those small details through everything that Alan's done since the early 90s. You know, the wanting to be on telly, Stephen McComb having the short, violent temper, things like nosebleeds, the love of Sherlock Holmes, the hatred of gypsies, just like, it's great that those things still exist in Alan's kind of character arc, like 25 or more years later. And that, you know, and also things like the statements of self-affirmation being a key trait, like, you know, that I'm Alan Partridge, I, Alan Partridge, I am Alan Partridge, of that there is no doubt. Like, they're so prominent across the output of Alan as well. And it's like, that beautifully double-layered thing where it's narcissistic because it's putting himself at the centre, but it's also his kind of defence mechanism. It's how he rallies against any moments of self-doubt or moments of calamity on the show. It just sends it all back to him, which, so it makes perfect sense that then what followed was I'm Alan Partridge being the title for the sitcom, because that recurring motif, I'm Alan Partridge, and of that there is no doubt. It's really great to go back across all these shows, and it's all there.
I'm fully prepared to take quite a few pelters on this on Twitter, but I would almost say that I kind of struggled with this series a little bit. I didn't find it as funny. I think it's, with the possible exception of Alpha Papa, the least I've laughed at an Alan series or piece of output. Doing the notes ended up almost being a bit of a slog in the end for me, and I do have a theory for that. So people who have championed doing this series to us on our social, say, will you do this, you should do this. I'm not saying everyone, but I would be quite confident in saying that they are of a slightly older demographic. Mm-hmm. So the chances are that this series is their entry point for Alan, was their entry point for Alan. So they hold it in a lot more regard and they feel a lot more nostalgic towards it than someone like me who is, you know, not that young anymore, but younger than, you know, wasn't around when this was being broadcast first of all in 1992, because my entry point, Alan, was I'm Alan Partridge series 2. Now, when we've done those series, we kind of agreed that series 1 was slightly better than series 2, but I hold series 2 in a lot higher regard than I think other people do, because that was my entry point for Alan and the one that I've watched the most and discussed at the time with my friends in school when we were about 17. So that's the one that I have the most regard for.
It's that thing, isn't it? That like everyone's favorite band was formed when they were a teenager, basically. Yeah. Everybody's favorite era of music is usually the one that they grew up during. So it's,
So that's the thing. I think you're right. The people that have been advocates for this, where their go-to quotes will be from this radio show, whereas like my go-to quotes would probably be I'm Alan Partridge series 1 and yours would be I'm Alan Partridge series 2, for example. It's definitely that, I think.
Yeah. And I think that's fine. If you think that this is better than, if this is your favourite Alan, then obviously, you know, that you're perfectly entitled
to
that opinion.
It's not bad.
I'm not saying it's bad by any means, but I'm just saying I struggled to kind of click with it a little bit, I think, because of that. And what I did get from this series, I probably found it more interesting than I did funny, because it's the birth of the character really and kind of it's his own vehicle rather than just sporadic appearances on other shows. So it's interesting to see what is still there from Alan, what has been removed. And I think it's a testament to the character about that he kind of, and the writing, that he kind of comes out almost fully formed, because there's a lot of stuff that has carried on. It's not, there has been stuff that has been developed, there's stuff that's been stripped away and stuff that's been embellished on, but it is kind of, he is a fully formed character when he comes out in the show, and I think that's great. And also
Do you find that quite surprising?
I did. Yeah, because I think that shows just how good they are, like the people who created this and Steve who acts it, obviously. And I think the last point I'll make is that, you know, where I obviously, you know, will cut them slack of saying that I don't find this quite as funny, it's important, I guess, to remember that at this point, Coogan was 27, Marber was 28, and Iannucci was 29, and they were just discovering the character and developing him as it went along. So I'm probably not going to be as a fan of this, because my Partridge was more developed even than this, and this is pretty developed. So my Partridge is I'm Alan Partridge series 1 and 2, but more series 2. and he's a bit more developed and there's more to him than in this series, because you have the wider context of the other characters, what he's done up until that point, and everything that happens in that series. And whereas you don't have that here, and you get a little bit from the documentary, but not so much. But yeah, I think in sort of summary, I found it, yeah, like I said, more interesting than I did actually funny. Like, it wasn't a bad experience, but I just didn't find it as funny. And I just think that's because it's not my Alan, but that's fine.
Okay, large question to the group. If we had to pit the two against each other, what is better, Kim Ki-wap radio or Kim Ki-wap TV?
Oh, TV all day.
I think TV, but it's an unfair fight because it's been informed by what did and didn't work on radio.
I mean, I totally agree with what you just said. Can I just shock you?
And the other thing is that watching the Knowing Me, Knowing You TV show, I'd watched clips of it. I hadn't really watched very much of it until it came to doing it for this podcast. Mm-hmm. I loved that process. I think that is possibly my third favourite Alan series, I think. Compared to this, I think, it, like Adam says, it's chalk and cheese. It's difficult to actually compare them. They've obviously, the radio show influenced the TV show, but they are still thematically similar, but in terms of, you know, the experience watching them or listening to them, they're very, very different.
And it's like we talked about, every gag is kind of embellished and made bigger with the TV show, which kind of makes sense, obviously, because you do have the visual medium as well as the audio to play with.
Absolutely. Go on.
Oh, so I was going to say, I probably actually would be a defender of the radio over the TV. Personally, okay. I just think that I like comedy as an audio form over visual, and I think that it presents certain challenges to writers that I think that they kind of lent into and were able to kind of deal with, because you might not always be straight to TV and you might be on radio, and you have to consider the fact that listeners can't necessarily see everything and how you kind of reflect that in the writing. And I think that they did a very good job of, you know, traditionally a TV chat show, just as a medium, is generally a visual thing, right? There's not loads of chat shows on the radio, but I think that this sort of neatly as a vehicle worked and reflected, I think, the fact that it was a very clever piece of writing, and I certainly defend it as something that I enjoyed probably more so than the TV show.
So any particular highlights or lowlights, favourite sketches, guests or episodes? I'm happy to pitch in for episode 3, which I think is my highlight. Michelle Lambert, the two hostages. I really like the dynamic and I really like the sort of tragic idea that you can have spent 2 years in captivity and still be the underdog even when you're on a chat show talking about it afterwards. And the threat of Uncle Dennis hanging over that episode as well. I really enjoyed that.
I think it's got to be episode 2, and it's Simon Fisher is the absolute standout for me. But actually, further to Tom's point, I think that was probably the first episode I heard, because, you know, I talked about in CDs that the first CD is episode 2 and episode 6. So I think, interestingly, the episodes that I always enjoy the most and I find I laugh most at probably are the first two episodes that I heard. So basically, Tom, your theory is bang right.
I would personally be an advocate for episode 4, which is the Sandra Peaks one, which I know is not necessarily everyone else's favourite, but I enjoyed what they did with that character. It tied in nicely with the knowing me, knowing you. So I kind of enjoyed that, and that would be probably my favourite.
I think my favourite is the last episode, I think. I enjoy whenever Alan interacts with Tony Hares. Throughout the timeline, I always enjoy when those two are together. Almost to a point where I actually, you know, they probably did do the right thing in terms of killing him off and him not being a thread throughout the APU, and also that doesn't make narrative sense either. And then obviously the Lord Morgan of Glossop sort of ending, I really enjoy that character. I really enjoy, you know, I've said it multiple times on the TV show, TV show of Know Me, Knowing You and the radio show, I'm a massive Patrick Marber fan of him as a comedic actor, and I think he's brilliant as Lord Morgan of Glossop.
I think the Tony Hares segment is probably my second favourite bit, because I love the bit with the call. I love whenever you have Alan interacting with the general public, because essentially they all hate him and it always goes really, really badly wrong.
And he never really learns to screen those calls either.
Why haven't they been cut off?
Well, I suppose when you get to Mid-Morning Matters, he knows that he should screen them, but he literally doesn't have enough callers to pick and choose, does he? So I think that brings us to the end of our conclusions for Knowing Me, Knowing You Radio. If any of you have thoughts, please do get in touch. It's thepartridgepod@gmail.com, facebook.com/thepartridgepod. We're at thepartridgepod on Twitter, at monkeytennispod on Instagram, and the Monkey Tennis hotline is 07923 600 017. On that bombshell, that brings us more or less to the end of this series of Monkey Tennis, but if you've enjoyed what you've heard and feel like shouting us a coffee to show us your appreciation, we'd certainly love that. It's ko.com
ko-fi.com/monkeytennis, and you can drop us a coffee, or if you're feeling generous, buy a round of coffees so that producer Jed gets to drink one.
Yay!
As well. He's dangerously low on caffeine. He's only had 7 today.
He needs some reward for doing this.
So thanks very much to all of you that have listened, participated, subscribed and rated us at Monkey Tennis. We really do appreciate it, and we'll be back with more Alan to come. As we know, there's plenty more new Alan on the horizon as well, so you can rest assured we'll be reviewing that in due course. Thanks so much, and from all of us at Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge Fan Podcast, goodbye.
Bye. See
ya. Welcome to Knowing Me, Knowing You. Knowing me, Alan Partridge, knowing you, the audience. I've got a hit on my hands.
Monkey Tennis?
Is that good therapy or balmy old cack?
Conrad Knightson.
Monkey Tennis?
I'm Alan Partridge.
Why are you such a prick?
Lots of meaty chat.
Monkey Tennis?
I just want you to admit that you hate Les Dennis.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
Monkey Tennis?
Okay, I'm in Manhattan. What do I do now?
You are a little shit.
Monkey Tennis?
That in England is a whore.
I've taken drugs!
Lord Morgan?
If you speak again, I will physically hit you.
And on that bombshell...
Monkey Tennis?
Thank goodness it's radio. I never thought I'd say that.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.